I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. Voters have decided to give Governor Rick Scott 4 more years. The race was costly and negative between Scott and Republican-turned-Democrat challenger Charlie Crist, but Scott won out eventually by 100,000 votes Tuesday night. Republicans also won big in tight Central Florida House races. Rene Plasencia, Mike Miller, Scott Plakin, and Bob Cortez all defeated Democratic incumbents.
And I've told people, if you thought last night was loud, it's going to be a sleepy little dream compared to the hurricane that's coming at us in 2016.
To discuss last night's election results and voter turnout in the midterm election, I'll speak with political commentator Frank Torres, UCF political scientist Aubrey Jewett, and Seminole County Supervisor of Elections Mike Ertel. A roundtable discussion of the 2014 midterm elections, that's ahead on Intersection. I'm joined in the studio by Mike Ertel. Mike is the Seminole County Supervisor of Elections. Welcome to the program, Mike.
Thanks for having me.
Also joined by political analyst in Central Florida here, Frank Torres. Frank, thanks for coming in.
Great to be here.
And by phone, we're joined by University of Central Florida Professor of Political Science, Aubrey Jewett. Aubrey, nice to have you back.
Yeah, great to be here.
Well, first of all, Rick Scott obviously re-elected to a second term an earlier night than some folks were expecting. He beat out Charlie Crist by roughly 100,000 votes. Frank, was this the outcome you were expecting?
It was the outcome I was expecting, but with last-minute polling that had Charlie Crist up slightly, well within the margin of error, it wasn't the outcome many were expecting. A lot of people were expecting a late night, a decision possibly expected the next morning. But to get in a call, to get AP calling it at 10:35, really was a much earlier result that we expected. You know, and Rick Scott had a significant financial advantage and was able to use Charlie's past against him. And, you know, he also used a lot of numbers. And I think a lot of people looked at the economy that was in front of them and thought that maybe they were heading in the right direction and it wasn't the right time to make a change.
Do you think it's difficult for voters, though? You know, there was so much money poured into advertising. A lot of it, as you say, was negative. Is it difficult for voters to kind of separate out the negativity and just focus on the numbers, for example?
You know, we were dealing with a very tired, very beaten electorate. They had been watching negative ads for months. For most of the campaign, both candidates went straight for the negative over each other's past. Rick Scott's past with HCA Columbia and the massive Medicare fraud, and Charlie Crist's past with the GOP and his reverse of positions on most of the issues. So these two wasted no time at the beginning of the campaign calling each other out by name and pointing out each other's shortcomings as a governor and each other's mistakes while in office.
Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, you know, back to the night itself, did you have any kind of thought that Charlie Crist might try and push things a wee bit and not concede as early as he did?
You know, Charlie Crist had been a wide-open critic about Rick Scott's hours at the polls. He criticized Rick Scott for not doing enough to keep the polls open in 2012 and for not trying to reduce the numbers in line. So when we saw that little event pop up in Broward County, it seemed to fall right in line with the criticism that Crist had been issuing Scott throughout the campaign. That was allowing the electorate the proper opportunity to vote. So it sure looked like he was setting it up for a long time, and there was some hesitation from his campaign to concede, that they were considering the possibility of challenging that, but the judge came down and made a ruling, from what I understand, pretty quickly that he didn't get the extension that he wanted, and that's the way it rolled out.
Mike Ertel, Supervisor of Elections in Seminole County, what was going through your mind at that point when you saw that late in the day filing from the Crist campaign?
Well, I mean, also that this weekend we saw it as well with an attempt to extend the early voting hours down in Broward County as well. I think what happens a lot in campaigns is if you see something and you're not liking the way that the final score may turn out to be, you try to move the goalpost a little bit, and you can't move the goalpost. The electorate needs to have a sense of comfort and confidence in how long the voting hours are, in what the voting process is, and if you're continually changing everything day by day, even, that doesn't give the electorate comfort in the process. And we have to recognize that we are Florida. And Florida does need to make sure that we provide that comfort to the voters.
Do you think candidates are getting advice from, you know, their campaign staff on the kind of optics of making a move like that, you know, whether it might sort of hurt them down the track, whatever happens in this election or whatever election they're involved in?
Well, I mean, you'd have to really talk to the candidates about what the political aspect of that is. And maybe Frank is, or Aubrey is more qualified to talk about the political optics of things. But from an administrative point and from a voter's standpoint, you see that and it does not reflect well. And it makes the process looks like something that perhaps can the process be changed midway through the game? Can it be changed at the end of the game? The fact that the judge came down and said, no, it cannot. I think that gave the voters comfort in knowing that the process is working and that their system of electing folks is one that is stable. And that's really what we need in Florida is a stability and a comfort level for our voters.
What about, say there was an extension granted, how would that be communicated to voters?
Well, and that's a great question. How would that have been communicated? In the past, from an administrative standpoint, when Governor Crist was governor, he did extend hours of the polling locations for one of the elections. And we simply communicated to the voters as quickly as we can. We now have the ability to do these things like on social media and immediately make that communication to folks. In the past, in years past, you would have to post. I mean, in Florida law right now, it says if something changes, you have to post a flyer on 5 public buildings. And that's 5 public buildings. That's not going to tell the entire county or the entire region, wherever the scope is, what has changed.
So you literally have to have somebody out there with a bill sticker and a pot of paste, like sticking these
basically,
things up.
Yes. And we have we have provisions for everything. I mean, we already have everything templated out. If something happens, we just need to plug the dates, print them up, because we still have to do that five building posting. But with the social media aspect of everything, now you can really touch everybody very quickly. There's so many people that are on social media, but not everyone is. There is still a digital divide, mm-hmm. and we have to be cognizant of that and not ignore our more Luddite-based consumers.
Aubrey Jewett, UCF political science professor, were you kind of preparing for a long night Tuesday night?
Well, I definitely thought it could be a long night, and was a little surprised when it was called a little earlier than I expected. I wasn't totally surprised by the results. I think, as Frank indicated, I thought, if anything, maybe there was slight momentum for the Crist campaign, just based on one or two polls late. But even those polls only showed him with maybe a point lead. Everything was within the margin of error. And, of course, you have 3 or 4 polls over the last 10 days that showed it dead even. And so, indeed, it was even. But I think the Republican Party did a great job with turnout, as they often do. And the Democratic Party, unfortunately for them, in the off-year elections, when there's not a president at top, particularly like President Obama, their turnout went down. Statewide turnout was about 50%. But in some of the strongholds for the Democratic Party, mainly Broward and Miami-Dade, for instance, it was in the low 40s. So turnout was just much lower there.
How do you think they get around that or try and overcome that turnout deficit in future midterm elections? Because it seems like that's a perennial problem. Obviously, if you don't have a presidential candidate, it's going to be tough. But with a race as tight as the Crist Scott race, some folks were saying, well, this is going to boost turnout a wee bit, but it just didn't seem to happen.
Well, yeah. Normally, when you have a really close race at the top of the ticket, whether that's a presidential race, a Senate race, or a governor's race, that does tend to stimulate turnout. But I think because of all the money spent on negative ads for so long, that had a little bit of a depressive effect. And quite frankly, we're 6 years into President Obama's term, and so you have these national political factors that were hitting all the states, including Florida. And so Republicans were fired up. Independents/swing voters were leaning Republican because they didn't like President Obama, and Democrats were a little discouraged. And so you add all that up, throw in the mix more money for Republicans and for Rick Scott, and you end up with a 1-point victory in a purple state like Florida.
You mentioned Obama's approval rating. It's 6 years in. People aren't too happy with the way things are going. This happens a lot in two-term presidencies. I wonder if maybe they should shorten the presidency and make it 3 years.
Yeah, there's a thought in terms of the electoral consequences. We usually do see that 6-year itch. It's been very rare when we have it. Occasionally we have it. I think, for instance, under Bill Clinton, he was able to avoid it. But usually, you do see some voter fatigue after somebody's been in office, even for a relatively popular president. Like, take going back just a little ways, somebody like Ronald Reagan, who was quite popular for most of his term, and actually by the time he left, his popularity recovered. But in his sixth year in 1986, the Republicans lost control of the Senate, and they lost some state houses and governors and et cetera.
Mm-hmm. I want to turn to you now, Frank. The third-party candidate there, Libertarian Adrian Wiley, of course there were more than just three candidates on the ticket, but these are the three that polled highly, and Adrian Wiley was a long way behind Crist and Scott. It looked like he was making more of a dent in the polls going into the race, but he finished with just 4%. That's about 200,000 votes. Did you expect him to do better than he did?
I did expect him to do a little bit better. I even expected him to flirt with double digits. You know, the Libertarian platform, it does appeal to a lot of weary voters, especially the kind of voters that we ran into this election cycle. You know, it's a little bit of both worlds, the fiscal policies of the Republican Party and the social policies of the Democratic Party. And with most of the Adrian Wiley supporters that I spoke to out there on the campaign trail were just tired of both candidates. But what I think ultimately happened is Adrian Wiley supporters either stayed home, they realized it wasn't worth it, and that Adrian Wiley didn't have a real shot at being competitive, or they decided that they wanted their vote to really count. Of course, every vote really counts. Mm-hmm. They wanted their vote to make a dent one way or the other. So I believe that 4% probably sapped off of both candidates, but I think that's probably what happened. One of those two things is probably what happened to Adrian Wiley's supporters. They either stayed home or they decided to go with one of the two mainstream candidates.
What about the money, too? Because, you know, all that money spent on the two top contenders, Adrian Wiley, a drop in the bucket compared to that. Does it just come down to money?
Yeah, you know, it's all about money, I'm sure. It's sad, but it's true. It's all about money. But you could add, it does ask the question, what does a Libertarian candidate that has some money to play around with, some money to run some ads and to let people know what he's all about, what are they really capable of? Could they be really competitive? You know, Adrian Wiley's supporters, while they were few, were very passionate. You know, I had a chance to cover a couple of his events, and there was a good attendance. But, you know, he didn't have the money to spread the message, and he wasn't out there asking for money, really. So, I mean, what it does ask the question, you know, what could a Libertarian candidate or a candidate that shares the combined beliefs of both parties in different regards do with some actual money, and how they could mold that message into an effective campaign?
Mm-hmm. Of course, there are other ways of getting attention. Adrian Wiley got some press by driving around without a license and saying to the police, come and arrest me. So there are other ways of generating some buzz.
Sure, there's probably some better ways of generating some buzz. He also wasn't allowed to debate, so he protested outside of the debate of each of the debates and waged war on the media that wouldn't let him into the room. So, you know, there is going to be a time for that kind of – for the Libertarian Party and for that kind of school of beliefs. It just wasn't 2014. It just wasn't in Florida.
Aubrey Jewett, what are your thoughts there? I mean, what is the future for third parties, whether it's the Libertarian Party or whether it's another political party in Florida or just in the United States in general? When is that time?
Well, I don't foresee that time, you know, in my lifetime, you know, over the next 20 years. We've seen a lot, you know, some occasional candidates who ran under third party banner who have attracted some votes, who did well. You know, Ross Perot, for instance, is probably the modern example. Somebody who ran as an independent, really started his own party, the Reform Party, and for a while was actually ahead of both Clinton and Bush in the polls. But then he sort of self-destructed, dropped out of the race, jumped back in. But whether it's Reform Party, Libertarian screens, you know, they have a difficult time for a couple of reasons. One, you know, most people just sort of expect that there's going to be Republicans and Democrats, that one of those is going to win. And so you get the phenomena where people sort of generically might be dissatisfied, for instance, this time around with both Crist and Scott, and say that they're intending to vote for the Libertarian. But then when push comes to shove on election day or, you know, election week or month, they don't. You know, and basically we saw the drop-off that most political analysts expected. Wiley was polling, in some cases, 8, 9, 10%, and most people thought, nah, probably going to be more like 4 or 5, and that's where he ended up. Mm-hmm. It's just sort of built into the system for Republicans and Democrats. They control nomination processes, and it's the chicken-and-egg problem, I guess, in one sense. It's the perception that voters have that if they vote for someone else, it's probably throwing away their vote. And, you know, that sort of feeds into the Republican and Democratic dominance.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. We're speaking to UCF political science professor Aubrey Jewett. We're also joined by political analyst Frank Torres and Seminole County Supervisor of Elections Mike Ertel. Mike, I want to turn back to you. Voter turnout, obviously a big topic of discussion this election cycle, and as has been mentioned many times, it's usually not that great in off-presidential years. What did you see in Seminole County?
We had a 55.35% turnout, which is 5% higher, 5 points higher than we had back in 2010, which is the like election. So our turnout was higher than we had 4 years ago, which is good. I mean, I think that the absentee and the early voting and getting out and voting before Election Day really had an impact on that.
What about, and you were talking about social media before, you're pretty active on Twitter, on Facebook, sending out those email blasts, encouraging people to early vote, just making it as easy as possible for people to go and cast their vote and be a citizen of this country. What do you attribute to, you know, the social media campaign? Do you think that kind of helps generate some of that buzz?
It absolutely does help. I mean, we have there are so many people that are online. I mean, there are, of course, folks that are not online, so you cannot ignore the non-online-based communications. But you also can't trivialize online communications as something that's only geared or garnered or sent towards 18 to 25-year-olds. That's not true. You know, on my Facebook page, most of the people that we interact with are, you know, folks that are well over 30 years old. You know, on the Twitter, it trends a little younger. And on Twitter, you have to be a little bit more, you have to do it more often because people tweet more often and the lifespan of a tweet is much shorter than the lifespan of a Facebook message. Facebook, on the other hand, is a lot more interactive. We do polls. You know, I ask specific questions, how you feel about certain things. Some things are funny. Some things are serious. And so you have to have that sort of interactivity because social media is a variety show. It is not a serious discussion show. It is not a comedy show. It's a variety show. You have to have a little something for everybody in every day.
Is it a bit of a fine line treading that you know, boundary between comedy and obviously doing some serious work?
Well, yeah, but in order for folks to get through the noise, if you're just constantly serious, 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 and then they'll say, okay, well, that is just, you know, somebody having a politician's tweets. And, you know, folks that are in elected office, they all need to do their own social media. You can't outsource your personality to somebody else. And if you try to do that, you're just going to adopt someone else's personality and you could end up getting bit, as a lot of companies have seen in the past, where they have someone that is not the you know, that's not really the face of the company doing the tweets, doing the Facebook messages, and they say something that they probably shouldn't say.
And we see that in political campaigns too. Frank, just sort of speaking about messaging and, you know, use of social media, what's your assessment of how Rick Scott has developed, you know, not just in social media, but just kind of being a politician, being a governor? You know, we heard from a congressman, John Michael, last night. He said, look, Rick Scott, he's a businessman, maybe more so than a politician. And he said that's a good thing. But how do you see his kind of development as governor of Florida?
You know, we have seen somewhat of a transformation of Rick Scott from businessman to politician. He's still mostly businessman. And I think Congressman Micah nailed it right on the head. The guy's never been a rock star. And it was a disadvantage he had going into the campaign against a more charismatic Charlie Crist. So what do? If you're not charismatic or a rock star, you surround yourself with rock stars. And that's what Charlie Crist did. You know, you saw him bring down Governor Rick Perry, Governor Bobby Jindal, his Lieutenant Governor Carlos Lopez Cantera. Very charismatic, very good on the microphone, and very in front of the camera. Even last night, as a victory speech, you know, it wasn't the most outstanding, you know, groundbreaking speech that you ever heard. It was relatively brief, relatively straightforward, and he's never going to be a rock star. And when his time in his office is done, you know, he'll be remembered mostly for what he's been able to do as far as job creation coming out of the recession. But he won't be considered one of the more animated governors of this state 30 or 40 years from now. And we'll see what he can do as far as that legacy goes. Maybe he can open up with a little. Maybe now that he's got a second term, he'll open up a little bit more. You know, not try to be as as stoic as he's used to being, maybe open up the doors to the media a little bit more. We'll see where he goes. But it really is about, you know, he's definitely found a way to work around the lesser charismatic parts of his personality.
Mm-hmm. Aubrey Jewett, Frank just mentioned Carlos Lopez Cantera there. Obviously, there was a bit of an issue with Governor Scott's first lieutenant governor. How do you see Carlos Lopez Cantera kind of helping advance Scott's brand, if you will?
Well, I think he was a very strategic choice after a very, very long time. You know, once the governor decided he really should have a lieutenant governor, I guess, and made the pick, you know, he picked a South Florida Hispanic, Cuban Hispanic. And what we have seen in Florida over the last few years is the Hispanic vote drifting to the Democratic Party, and even the Cuban vote beginning to drift to the Democratic Party, particularly among younger Cubans. So by picking a dynamic Cuban from South Florida and putting them on the ticket, I think it helped. You know, it was still, you know, although it was 100,000 votes, it's still only a 1% race. And I think that definitely was a help in South Florida and Miami-Dade and the Cuban community.
Mm-hmm. What do you think Lopez Cantera's future holds? Because it's often said that a lieutenant governor position in Florida isn't a great political office. It's a lot of time it's kind of decorative, if you will. But what do you think Carlos Lopez Cantera might have in his political future?
Well, I think it depends on a couple of things. One, the lieutenant governor's job is really only as much or as little as the governor allows it to be. So if, you know, Governor Scott gives the lieutenant governor some responsibility, particularly if it's something, you know, meaningful and something that actually brings him out into the public a little bit, then perhaps he could use the lieutenant governor's position as a springboard for some other statewide office or other election. On the other hand, if Governor Scott does not really give him too much to do, then probably it won't do him any good politically and becomes a political graveyard or worse. You know, they say idle hands are the devil's workshop, and I think that's what happened to Jennifer Carroll. Perhaps she didn't have anything to do.
I think that might be accurate. Yeah.
Let's just quickly talk about some of the amendments. Amendment 2, the measure to legalize medical marijuana, didn't receive the necessary votes. It was just a couple percentage points short of the required 60% to pass. Frank, this measure saw overwhelming support earlier. Now, we talked about this on Tuesday night.
Yes, sir.
What happened?
You know, I think it was perhaps the best counter-messaging that we saw in the Florida elections this year was the No on 2 message against medical marijuana. They had a very creative message. They called it the Drug Dealer Protection Act, capitalizing on the gaps in the language with the legislation. Could children get their hands on it due to the lax language? Could you prosecute people who hurt other people with their marijuana? There wasn't any real accountability tied up with the legislation, and I think the No on 2 folks did a better job of taking that message to the voters than the United for Care or the Yes on 2 people. Mm-hmm. Keep in mind, this thing was polling very high at the beginning of the year. I believe it was in the upper 80s, and just watch it go down like this, to see it drop so far and so fast, really does say something about the messaging from both campaigns and the issue itself. There was a very prominent super attorney that was the face of this this campaign. The way he communicated his message was up for question as well. Mm-hmm. But at the end, it just really came down to raising the red flags or the possible red flags on such a controversial legislation, and that was ultimately the downfall. And you know, a lot of people thought it would be in the lower 50s. A lot of people didn't pick 58%. A lot of people were saying 51 or 52. But there were some compassion votes in there, I believe. I believe a lot of people went to the polls and they thought about possibly the good it could do. And it got bumped up a few points there. But ultimately, the messaging against medical marijuana was just too strong and definitely the best counterattack politically I saw in Florida this year. Mm-hmm.
Mike Hertel, there was talk before the election of this amendment being a factor in driving people to the polls. Do you kind of have any data on whether that got people out to vote this time around?
Or whether or not it would be a higher turnout? It did, you know, it did drive some people to the polls. And we saw we were doing voter registration drives over the summer. People would come up to us and want to register to vote solely for the purpose of, you know, they're saying, I want pot legalized. And so they would want to register to vote for that reason. So I do think it actually increased the voter turnout a little bit, but not the level of impact that I think that some of the organizers thought it would. Mm-hmm. There's in every election, there's always going to be people rooting for something, and then there's going to be people voting for something. And the object of every candidate and every campaign is to turn those rooters into voters.
Aubrey Jewett, really quickly, there were a few amendments on the Orange County Charter, four in fact. These all pretty much went the way that folks who put them up there wanted them to. Could you just quickly talk us through some of the key ones? For example, Amendment A, citizens wanting to make a change to the county's charter. You know, there's now a longer wait time before that can actually get on the ballot. What does this do for citizen-led initiatives?
Yeah, well, Orange County Charter had some interesting but perhaps not too surprising results. The thought that people would like a little more time to be able to examine potential charter changes, and that was what that was about. Also, I think a little bit about trying to make it more difficult to get them on the ballot in the first place. And then on the issue of sort of partisan races versus nonpartisan, I don't think it was real surprising, given that although third parties are probably not going to form, you know, we do have a lot of people who are beginning to not register with either major party, and the thought that partisanship is just out of control right now. So you saw basically the one that said, let's make the constitutional offices nonpartisan and put some term limits, fairly long term limits, but term limits on them. You know, that passed. Whereas the other one that would have made currently nonpartisan offices partisan, you know, did not pass. I thought that was not entirely unexpected, but of course you never know what the voters are going to do.
Mm-hmm. And finally, Frank Torres, are you excited for 2016?
You know what? Everything last night was just a big preview for 2016. And, you know, it's going to be a three-ring circus. You're going to have two presidential primaries. If Bill Nelson retires, you'll have a Senate race. If Rubio runs for president, you'll have, you know, another one. There's just so much going on. And I've told people, if you thought last night was loud, it's going to be a sleepy little dream compared to the hurricane that's coming at us in 2016. Yeah, you saw some gubernatorial or some possible presidential hopefuls out there with the candidates over the last couple of days. Most of them were with Governor Rick Scott. You had Bobby Jindal, Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal. You had Texas Governor Rick Perry, who seems to be much better spoken this time around. Mm-hmm. Governor Chris Christie and two homegrown products. You know, Jeb Bush, who's already gotten a green light from his family to run, and Florida Senator Marco Rubio, who's already said he's ready to be president. On the other side, right now, it's mostly just the Hillary show. If her health holds up, she'll likely be the person that the Democrats turn to. If she decides not to run, then watch out, because you're going to have about half a dozen people going for it if she can't make it. Most likely, Elizabeth Warren, the senator from Massachusetts. So it's going to be an exciting race, and we're all going to be in for a treat there.
I've been speaking to political analyst Frank Torres. We've been talking about the election night wrap-up, also joined in the studio by Mike Hertel from the Seminole County Supervisor of Elections Office, and joined on the phone by UCF Professor of Politics Aubrey Jewett. Thank you all for joining me.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks
for having me.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at wmfe.org/intersection. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Brendan Byrne is assistant producer. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.